The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Great to see so many friendly names and faces in our chat rooms. And of course, welcome to all of you who are listening in a way that doesn't give you a chat room. You're missing out on part of the fun, but we welcome you nonetheless. We've got a great ghost-oriented show for you tonight. We're going to be talking with Mark Leslie. Mark is an author. He's written a lot of nonfiction and fiction. But tonight we're going to talk about the nonfiction stuff, particularly the nonfiction paranormal stuff. His new book is called Haunted Hospitals. We're going to talk about those hospitals, his stories, and some of his other paranormal work as well. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel and our Twitch channel. Both of them can be found just by going to JV Johnson. Just search JV Johnson. You'll find the channels. Subscribe and follow or whatever you have to do. If you want to subscribe to the Twitch channel and you have an Amazon Prime account, you can use that Amazon Prime account. You can connect it and you'll get basically a free subscription to the Twitch channel. You can follow without having to have a subscription, but the subscription gives you some bonuses and benefits and stuff like that. So anyway, we've got a lot of great things going on, a lot of great people in our chat rooms, and the chat rooms are associated with our YouTube channel and our Twitch channel if you're looking for them.
Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/Johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W.
Mark Leslie is our guest. He's an author. We're going to be talking about several of his nonfiction books that relate to the paranormal, including the new one called Haunted Hospitals. Mark, welcome to the program. It's great to have you with us tonight.
No, I'm delighted to be here. And I have to say, I have no hair, so no flicking is happening at all.
Well, you know, it's funny. As I was starting to tell this anecdote and I started to bring you into it, I remembered that you don't have any hair, so you probably don't have that same problem. But we all are struggling through this in our own way, I suppose. But, you know, one of the things that I find really fascinating and that excites me about this conversation is I've heard you speak about this before, and I see a lot of parallels in some of your experiences as a child or as a youth and mine, particularly as it relates to being afraid of the dark. And you're still afraid of the dark.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, I'm sitting here 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, all the lights on in the room because, you know, you never know.
And where does this come from? Because I know where it came from me, and I still have some of these same fears too. So I'm right in the same boat. But where did it come from for you?
I can't identify a specific instance in my life. I just know I've always been afraid of the dark. I've always been afraid of the dark, and I think because there's always something that can be hiding in the dark, and it's that fear of the unknown that I've always had. Really overactive imagination as a child, and so I was seeing things in the dark, seeing monsters under the bed, seeing them in my closet, the whole bit. Where did yours come from? Because I can't determine what the source was. It was just an overall fear.
Well, I had, I had this fascination with late night horror movies. And I'm talking about when I was still quite young, you know, 6-7 years old. And I would beg my mother to stay up and watch some of these movies. And I can vividly remember watching the original Bela Lugosi Dracula for the first time. I could not sleep in my room with the lights off and without my mother used to make these wooden crosses and put them around the floor, around my bed, you know, to ward off vampires for weeks,
really?
Mark. And it still kind of haunts me to this day.
It's funny you should mention an old movie like that because The Changeling, George C. Scott.
Oh, yeah.
I think I must have, my parents were up and I got up to go to the washroom and I must have seen just a few scenes, which were enough to imprint on my memory. There was the ball bouncing down the stairs, the wheelchair, and then there was the walking. I just remember walking up the stairs to this door, and there was a door in our basement to the basement washroom that looked the same. No, most doors look the same, right?
Sure,
they have the same look and feel.
Right.
But I was convinced that the basement door in our house was the door from The Changeling and that there was something behind that door that I shouldn't go into. So, it's funny how those movies you see as a child can just haunt you to this day.
I have this film, and I'm starting to doubt whether my memories are accurate, but there's this scene of a film that still sits in my mind, and I've been dying to figure out what film it is. I remember it in black and white, but then again, we had a black and white television when I was a kid. So that could have been the problem. I'm not sure. But it was this scene of a woman in a bed in a bedroom, and the door up to the bedroom was open. You could see down the hall. And at the end of the hall, like, I think her husband was in the other room. But in the bed that she was in, underneath, a trap door started to open. And something was coming out of this trap door. And that's all I can remember. And I have been searching for this film forever. Now, it could have been a TV show. It could have been anything.
Right,
you know,
right.
My memory tells me it was a film I was watching with my mom. But who knows? But it still scares me.
And you never know. You're going to mention it one time, and sometime a listener is probably going to know what it is and write in and tell you about it.
Yeah, I think that's my hope, too. I hope that actually happens. And the other thing, and I think that you still have this sense that, you know, geez, what's hiding under the bed? I'm not going to let my arm dangle over because I know something's down there.
Of course. Yeah.
And I can.
Yeah, actually, we have a bed right now that it's just a box spring that sits right on the floor because it's perfect because no monsters can hide under that. It's ideal for me.
See, that's genius right there. You've solved the problem. And the other thing I can't do is I can't sleep without covers because I know that the covers are my shield against anything evil that might be lurking in the room at night.
Of course, they're magic. It doesn't matter how hot it is in the middle of summer. You still need just that thin layer of magic to protect you.
Yeah, and in fact, I have to compensate by making sure the room is like cooled to 66 degrees so that I can make sure I can have those covers on because there's a method to our madness here, Mark. This is not random.
Of course. No. There's a grand design to all this.
So you've written a lot of nonfiction. You've written fiction. You've about 20 books or so, I think, maybe more.
Yeah. Yeah, a little more.
How'd you get started?
I think, I was always, I had this overactive imagination, so I always saw, and it tended to be darker, scarier things. I always wondered what if, right? So when I was a child, I remember going out in the woods and, if I saw something in the woods, I assumed it was Bigfoot, right? Not a bear or not some other creature. I assumed it was some sort of supernatural, cryptoid kind of figure that was inexplainable. And so whenever I wanted to tell stories or I imagined things, I always wanted to share stories to, I don't know, maybe I wanted to make other people as scared as I was so that I wouldn't be alone. Maybe, misery loves company, but there's nothing I love more, even now as an adult, sitting around a campfire and just sharing a scary story. Like that to me is the ultimate thing. It's when you can actually have a group of people around there. And I remember that from Cub Scouts when I was a kid, just waiting for my turn to tell a story, and there's those classic ghost stories that you just get repeated and regurgitated over and over and over, the tales of the hook and the couple in the car and whatever, right? So that just drew me, and I always wanted to explore the what if. It wasn't until I was an adult that I started to do the nonfiction true ghost stories. I didn't even realize it's a thing that I could do.
Those ghost stories, one that sticks in my mind is this. I don't even know how the story goes, and I'm a horrible storyteller. I just don't have that gift. But I know that the end of this particular story, I think it's a girl sitting in the chair, and she's quote unquote petting the dog, and it turns out it wasn't the dog, it was the lunatic that broke into the house's hair. You know that?
That's
one of the good ones.
Her hands, and she thought it was the dog licking her, and she would reach out for comfort, and he would lick her hands. Oh my God! Yeah, those kind of stories. I loved those stories, and I thought it'd be fun to make those stories up, and that's what I do. I mean, a lot of my stories are very Twilight Zone-ish in nature. They're kind of reality, but they have some weird some weird twist to it.
Makes them fun.
And, yeah.
What is it about the thrill of controlled, I'll call it, controlled fear, that most people have that desire to be in a controlled environment and to get scared a little bit? Where does that come from?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we do it in roller coasters and things like that. But I think what happens is when you read about it, when you watch a movie, when you're sharing a story, it ends, right? It's over. And whether or not you can explain what the evil thing was that was trying to get everyone, it's over and you can escape from it, unlike, a lot of reality. So I think there's a cathartic thing. For me as well, it's almost, not that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, but sometimes I'll relate this to hot peppers. When I was younger, I couldn't eat a lot of hot and spicy food. Just a drop of Tabasco in a giant thing of chili would be more than I could bear. but you slowly gain a little bit more tolerance.
Right.
And so you just need a little bit more spice to make it painful and enjoyable. It's just a little bit more spice and a little bit more spice. And I think sometimes I feel that way because I'm still a chicken. But I was like, well, hey, I've actually gone on ghost walks in a group of 20 or 30. I've actually gone on ghost walks. I've actually gone exploring with one other person in a haunted hotel, you know, looking for Angelo the ghost. You know, I'm that brave now. I would never do it myself. But I think as you get more and more acclimatized, you're willing to try a little bit more and sort of test your own limits, which I think we're always testing our own limits as humans.
I'm curious as to what you think, since you obviously have created some of these stories, whether they're thrillers or horror type stories yourself. How does the ending affect us? Now, we just talked about the fact that most people enjoy the thrill of that controlled scare. But, you know, there was a time when most of these movies ended on a positive note or a hopeful note. And in fact, there's a classic story about one of my favorite films, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where the original ending was too dark. So they made them add the tag ending where there was going to be a hope for mankind to survive at the end. But that's not so much true anymore. A lot of movies end very darkly. How do we as people handle those two different types of endings, whether it's a hopeful ending or a very somber or dark ending?
It's interesting because I think it's difficult for Hollywood to get away with those dark endings. Like you said, they had to redo the ending of the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers because it was just too dark. It was just too disturbing. But then sometimes the happy ending, when it's satisfying or has a positive resolution, I think of the end of The Stand, for example, one of, you know, Stephen King's masterpieces.
Right.
You know, both the novel and I remember the television series version that I watched. You know, the hand of God comes down and just saves everyone at the end. You're like, well, what? Really? I wasted, you know, 12,000 pages or 1,200 pages just to get to this? Yes, the good guys win, but that's not the way I want them to win. I don't want some magic thing to come down and save everyone. So I think we need the ending to make sense according to all of the details that the creator set forth, like that the writer, that the storyteller set forth. And so when you think about a movie like The Sixth Sense, no spoilers here, but when you look at The Sixth Sense, you feel, oh my God, M. Night Shyamalan tricked us. No, he didn't trick you. He led you to believe something based on you making a whole bunch of assumptions
in a
series throughout the whole movie. And you get to the end, and you can't be mad at him because he didn't tell you that. You know, that Bruce Willis's character was dead.
Right.
But he didn't tell you who was alive.
Right. Again, so, you were making the assumptions all the way along.
Yeah, exactly.
And I actually like, I don't know if it was the follow-up movie to that, but The Village.
Oh, yeah.
I like that even more. And another ending with a twist.
Yeah. And again, when you look at movies like that where there's a twist, the storyteller is relying on what he knows the reader or the viewer is going to intuit based on facts.
Right.
Which shows us that reality can be deceptive, which also shows us that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our philosophies, that there are things beyond our comprehension that are there, but we just can't see them sometimes until it's too late.
Mark, you started writing as basically a preteen or an early teenager. Did you know at that point, I think at 13 years old, I saw that you wrote your first book.
Yeah.
Did you know at that point you wanted to be a writer as a professional?
Yeah, I knew. I knew I wanted to be a writer from those early times, those early days, just telling stories with little Fisher-Price characters when I was really young. And then when I discovered the permanence of I could put something on paper and walk away and someone else could pick it up and enjoy it, that was magic. That was powerful. So I knew I wanted to be a writer. What kind of surprised me was a story I wrote when I was in my teens. It was about a middle-aged man who was writing paranormal books on the paranormal, about UFOs and creatures and ghosts and stuff like that. And it was this dark, humorous story. And the main character was a middle-aged man writing true ghost story books. And that's what he did for a living. And I never realized that would become me, you know, 25, 30 years later. That kind of caught me by surprise. I remember going back to that story and saying, wait a second, I was writing about myself when I was, you know, I think I wrote that story when I was 16, and I didn't realize that that was going to be me in the future. So that was kind of a weird sort of foreboding that sometimes has happened in the writing.
I'm not going to say that you and I are old. I won't say that because we're not. However, we we're old enough to have lived through a very, what I would consider to be a major revolution in publishing. We went from, and not that we don't need libraries anymore, but libraries with volumes of printed books, and that's how you had to read your stuff. Now everything can be downloaded to a smartphone or a pad or a computer or whatever, and it's all digital. How has that changed the world for authors, and how has it changed it for the world for readers?
Oh, you know what? I say this because, you know, with a different hat on, I work in the book industry, and I help authors and publishers and readers with access to digital materials. I also, half my books are traditionally published, the other half are self-published. I think there's never been a greater time for readers or writers, because when you think about the history of publishing, you think about, you know, scrolls. Then Gutenberg invented the print and press, and that meant more people had access to it. Wasn't just, oh, if a monk could handwrite something for you, you could have it. So then the mass market paperback and pulp fiction meant, you know, more people could afford to read and enjoy these great science fiction stories and all kinds of great tales. And that birthed writers like Ray Bradbury, who really, you know, when you talk to most writers today who write speculative horror and science fiction, they credit people like Bradbury. But then when the Kindle came out and the iPad and all of the different ebook formats, suddenly more people had access to reading than ever before, regardless of location. I grew up in a small northern Ontario town with a small library. It was an hour drive into the big city of 90,000 people where there were bookstores. If I needed books and the library was closed, that was it. I couldn't get anything. Now I could just download them to my phone. So for readers, they've never had more choice. And for writers, more choice. I'll give you an example. Macabre Montreal was a recent book that I co-authored with Shana Krishnasamy. Now, Montreal's second largest city in Canada. And our editor actually had us cut four chapters from the book because he said they were too disturbing, too dark, too twisted. Two of them were about serial killers. And so we're releasing Too Macabre for Montreal ourselves, you know, in print and in ebook form. And again, it's only going to be about 15,000 words, but we feel that there's probably some readers who want those dark stories. It's called Macabre Montreal after all. So the thing I love about our publishing industry is I have a choice that I can work with publishers. And so, you know, Dundurn, a brilliant publisher, published Haunted Hospitals and Creepy Capital and Tomes of Terror and a whole bunch of my other books. You know, those books are available broadly through bookstores everywhere. They've gotten my books into Walmart, Costco. It's phenomenal. But they're never going to want to publish this 18,000-word collection of stories that they thought were too disturbing or too dark. But I can, and I can satisfy other readers who want those. And then people who don't want the disturbing, darker stuff, well, they stick to the lighter fare of Macabre Montreal. So I think it's amazing for both readers and writers that you can have those niche opportunities.
I'm going to tell you a fear that I have, and I want you to tell me if you think it's unfounded or if it's something we need to be vigilant about. My concern with the move to digital is that we don't have a printed record of some of this work, at least any significant printed record of some of this work. And if I take that a step further, I mean, we're seeing libraries pull books, classic works of literature, off the shelves because of what we consider to be some changes in political correctness or attitudes. But those are still classic works of literature, and they're being taken off these library shelves. Do we run the risk of, if we're in a digital publishing world, of having those works actually altered in a digital sense or censored in a digital sense that maybe a printed book form wouldn't be subject to, and you know, kind of a big brother approach to publishing? Is that a fear of yours? Because it's kind of a fear of mine.
Yeah, I think so. And it's kind of ironic because I'm not sure if you're familiar with this. This was the Kindle was only a few years old, and there was an invalid version, ironically, of George Orwell's 1984 that Amazon went and took out of everyone's Kindles. So they purchased it, and it was either an invalid or there's something wrong with it. There was some copyright issue with it. So they just pulled it. Been able to sell it. They ended up selling it, but they went. They're not going to sneak into your house and grab the book off the shelf,
right?
But they could get go into your Kindle and they can grab it. I also know because I worked for Kobo, which is Canada's version of Kindle, and I know that these companies can actually, they know what pages you're on in each of the books because they're stored in the cloud. They can see how fast you turn your pages. All of these amazing demographics, but a little bit terrifying. Now, when it comes to digital, yeah, you know, a sunburst could wipe out all of them. Electromagnetic pulse, we could lose them. But one of the things I learned when I worked at Kobo was people who read ebooks buy twice as many print books as they used to before they started reading ebooks because they're reading way more because they have access to, right, on their phones, on their Kindles or Kobos or the pads, the tablets they carry around. They're reading more because it's easier. Every book is a large print book, right? If you they have a dyslexic font, for example, which you can't, you know, always get that in a regular print book. So you, the book can suit your needs when it's electronic.
Right.
And then a lot of people, especially me, even when I do a lot of research, I buy a ton of books on, you know, true hauntings and things like that. I do the research. I may get an electronic book. I may buy the book for $5 or $8 electronically. But then if I really need to dig into it, I go and order a print copy or I get it from my local bookstore. I order it online and I use that for my research because I find the tactile experience of studying and reading. It seems to, it's also easier. I'm in my office right now surrounded by books. I can turn around and grab a book off the shelf way easier than I can open up my phone and try and find that locale. So I think there is that fear, but I think the book isn't dead. It just had babies, right? It's just a new format. So vinyl, when you think about electronic music, right, MP3s and Spotify and everything, vinyl is undergoing a huge resurgence. And vinyl hasn't died or gone anywhere. Now, 8-tracks did. But it kind of leads to the other question is, what's the real song? Is it the song that you can hear on your iPhone? Is it the song that you hear when you play the vinyl record? Is it the cassette? Is it the CD? What is the real song? And you get the same discussions when it comes to books. But the true story is that the actual communication between one human to another, the storyteller, that's the true story.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. I actually have been doing a side program using, I got out a couple turntables and I've been playing some vinyl and having a lot of fun remembering what it's like to actually invest yourself in putting a needle on a record and to play it as opposed to just flipping through your phone or whatever it happens to be. And I also say this, 8-tracks were just a bad idea from the start. They were just,
oh my God.
The audio quality of 8-tracks is so bad. I can't believe anybody ever bought them. Let me take this conspiracy idea one step further. And this really isn't the topic we're going to talk about tonight, but I find it fascinating and you really seem to know a lot about it. But if we take this whole Big Brother idea with publishing a step further, as you pointed out, you know, these companies can tell what page you're on or what books you have on your Kindle or your iPad or whatever it happens to be. What if in college I took some political courses and I read Mein Kampf. I read the Communist Manifesto. I read some really what would be considered controversial works. And what if someday along the line they say, you know what, anybody who's got Mein Kampf on their Kindle, we need to pay them a visit. I mean, that scares me a little bit.
You know, it's funny you should mention that because I actually wrote a short story, a horror story called Active Reader, which is about a bookstore loyalty program where a serial killer gets a hold of a database that basically, this is before digital books existed when I wrote this, that finds out what books people have bought. Because, you know, if you have a loyalty membership with a book chain, you know, they know what books you bought, where you bought them, what format, when you bought them, how you paid for it.
Right.
So he finds people who've read certain books and decides to kill them based on books that they've read. So, I mean, we've had that way before digital books. We've had that ability. And so I think I wrote that story out of a fear of, and this was early days of tracking. Like now, you know, almost every new beer I have is tracked on an app, right?
Yeah.
Where I had it, what I thought of it. There's so much information about us out there that, it could be a terrifying thing. Like, what if we decide that the books that you read have corrupted you and therefore you need to be eliminated?
There's
some real, I mean, and I think that's why I like to write speculative fiction because I ponder these things like you do, but then I wonder, well, well, what would happen? What would happen if suddenly they found out I read Mein Kampf, and, you know, when I, because I was studying politics in university, but they don't know that. They,
right.
You know, they just intuited that whatever. And so, yeah, there's all kinds of misinformation that can come from too much information.
Okay, so I think we've just done what most horror writers set out to do and scared a lot of people, but not with not with what would be traditionally considered a horror theme. Anyway, let's talk about ghosts a little bit, Mark. Much of your nonfiction work is related to retelling and exploring stories of hauntings and ghosts. You mentioned kind of developing an interest in this early, but when did you start really focusing on ghosts? And you said you've done some ghost hunting, if you will. Have you done a lot of that?
I've only done a little bit of ghost hunting with people who are more knowledgeable about it than me, like going out with experts. But I think I was never good at history, and I hated history. It's funny, I was talking to my 15-year-old son at dinner tonight, and he loves history. He just loves history class. It's so easy, Dad. And for me, it was, oh, this is boring. It's having to remember dates, and who cares what happened 100 years ago or 50 years ago? It makes no sense to me. And then I was on a ghost walk in Ottawa, Ontario, so Canada's capital, and these people were dressed in these beautiful black flowing robes, like Victorian dress, and had these old lanterns, and they were telling us ghost stories about the downtown core of Ottawa, but they couldn't tell the stories without relaying so much of the history. And so suddenly for me, history came alive, and I realized that you can't tell a good ghost story without understanding the people who came before you and all of the things that happened. And so that really, really fed my desire to want to tell the stories. And that's when I realized, I thought, okay, I like telling stories. I like scaring people. I like making things up. But I realized that you could tell true stories. You could gather information and details, and you could relay that story in such a way that you can provide the same amount of chills, and you could even not only entertain people, but you can inform them and inspire them to learn something about the city that they're in, or the locale, or the people, or the history, or whatever. And that really fueled my passion for wanting to tell those ghost stories. And that's kind of how the very first book I released in 2012, Haunted Hospitals, that was nonfiction paranormal. That's when I realized, hey, there's something here. Ironically, that was the first book I'd been nominated for a literary award for, and I thought, that's interesting. I get nominated for a literary award for a book of ghost stories, like true ghost stories. And you normally think that the literary culture would look down their nose at a book like that. So it was kind of ironic that that was the first time I'd been, I'd been honored with such an award. And so, yeah, that was, it's just kind of now I'm almost addicted to gathering stories. Anytime I hear someone start to tell a story, I lean forward and I was like, ooh, could you tell me more? Hey, would you mind telling me more? Could I use this in a book someday?
Have you noticed a change in attitude among people in terms of their acceptance of hauntings or ghosts, or even just the discussion of hauntings and ghosts? Have you, over the last 20 years or so, have you seen a change?
Yeah. You know what? I think it's funny. If I were to say, you know, I write horror stories, a lot of people would like turn, look the other way, not make eye contact with the crazy person and move. But when if I say, oh, I write true ghost stories, they lean in, and everyone is fascinated with what happens when we die. Everyone is fascinated with the unexplainable, the things that we just have no tactile means of identifying or laying down with scientific proof. Right? Well, we have measures and different tools that we use, you know, to measure frequencies and things for some paranormal experience. But for the most part, we can't explain it. And people are fascinated by that. And humankind has constantly wondered about that. I remember ghost stories around the turn of the century for the 1900s. Newspapers would have columns dedicated to ghost stories. And it almost feels like that's coming back again. That there is some underlying current in our world that is allowing people to want to share more openly about things they just can't explain. And so I think I've seen, just in the last 10, 15 years, a a stronger acceptance of people who actually want to talk about these things rather than, you know, sweep them under the carpet. Oh, no, we don't talk about that. No, I want to talk about this weird experience that I can't explain. I think I saw the spirit of, you know, my dead uncle, or I think I heard this disembodied voice of somebody who is 1,000 miles away, and I can't explain it. I think people really want to share those experiences.
When you started writing about this particular topic, or started to take an interest, the interest came earlier than the actual writing, did you go into it as a believer, as a skeptic, somewhere in between?
I went in as a believer, but the approach that I take when I write the books is I'm a believer with a skeptical attitude, because I am trusted by the reader to relay stories, and I'm not just going to take anything that sounds cool. I'm going to actually try to do some research, or at least relay what was told to me and try to illustrate it. And I'll give you an example. One of the stories from Haunted Hamilton was about Murder Mansion, and it was this mansion on Hamilton, Ontario Mountain, that the man in the middle of the night, a house people had avoided and had been boarded up for years and abandoned. The reason was because this guy had butchered his family with an axe he found in the shed in the middle of the night, and then he hung himself on the third floor widow's walk. And then, as the legend went, the next family that moved into the house, the 17-year-old boy found the very same axe and butchered the family in the exact same way and hung himself in the exact same location. Oof. And this is a great story. I loved it when I heard it. And I went in and to do sort of research the house and the historic and who built it and stuff like that. And then as I was looking into it, there were no axe murders in Hamilton in the 50-year period when that happened. And, I contacted the police because the other thing that bothered me is, well, wouldn't the axe be, if this axe was used as a murder weapon, would it still be in the shed, or would it be locked up in some evidence cabinet somewhere? So, when you put the story together, I went, huh, the story came out around the same time that The Shining was really popular, mm-hmm. with Jack Nicholson chasing his family around. Now, the stories about the ghosts in the house and all of the things, and there's still some weirdness about that lot that when the building got torn down, it's been 15 years now, and nothing has been built on that lot still for some bizarre reason, and it's prime real estate. I don't know why. But I wrote 2 or 3 pages in the book explaining why this probably isn't true, and here's why. And my editor came back and said, oh, you've got the true believer there, and would you just kick them right out of the book. What are you doing there? And I said, well, I've got to be honest with them because they have to believe in me. So we negotiated it down to at least a paragraph. And I still end the chapter with, okay, I don't think this one is real, but isn't it a cool story anyway? And you still can't explain those weird things people saw, right, in this abandoned house. The woman with the flaming red hair running screaming down the hallway as if someone were chasing her. Yeah, if you think back to the axe story, it's cool, but it's still kind of creepy on its own. And so those are the kinds of stories. So I do try to approach it with what I call a journalistic, I'm going to report the senses and what people explain, but I'm also going to approach it with a believer's attitude of saying, but we don't know or we can't explain what this is. What do you think this is? Because that's part of the fun of a ghost story, too.
It's interesting to draw the parallels between the origination of a story, the community that it originates in, and then what's going on in pop culture at the time. You mentioned The Shining, as it relates to the timeline of that particular story you just told. Another one that's perfectly good example of that is the number of possession stories that came out after The Exorcist, was a hit film, in fact, I actually attribute much of the Amityville saga to the success of The Exorcist. But it's funny to draw those connections and try to, connect those dots.
Well, it's funny because I did that when I was writing Spooky Sudbury. And Sudbury, Ontario, is a mining community, one of the nickel capital of the world, actually, and it's in mid-northern Ontario. And when I was first doing Spooky Sudbury, we thought, okay, there's going to be – I knew there was a weird thing that happened with UFOs in the 70s where they actually sent fighter pilots from Colorado Springs up to Sudbury to intercept these objects that they found in the sky. Oh, wow. And there's like pages and pages of classified documents because they never did reveal what happened in the skies over Sudbury. This was 1976, so I was a child living in the town there. I remember the freakiness of you know, didn't know if it was like the Russians coming in trying to invade or whatever. But I thought there might be a chapter on UFOs, but when I started to dig into the research, it was like the 50s. There's a chapter on the 50s, then the 60s, and the 70s. And one of the things I noticed is the patterns of the stories were very much tied to the culture, like you said. And I remember when Close Encounters came out, the movie, there was a lot of similar experiences. When movies like E.T. came out, there was a lot of experiences with seeing creatures like that. So you wonder if it's sort of one of two things. Are our imaginations fueled by the things that we saw, like those movies we talked about that we're frightened of? And so that helps sort of tinker with our imaginations a little bit. Or do we suddenly become aware of something that we may have not paid attention to before? It's kind of like when you recognize a new brand of car or something that a friend owns,
right?
And you've never seen that brand before, and then suddenly everywhere you go you see it on the road, and you're like, oh wow, everyone's got one of those cars now. I think it could be that too. Like maybe it was always there, maybe you just didn't see it before.
Tonight we're talking with Mark Leslie. Mark is an author. He's written books such as Haunted Hospitals, Spooky Sudbury, and others that tell ghost stories and tales of the macabre, if you will. And Mark, before we get back into talking about haunted hospitals, I have to ask you about something else that I found very interesting about you, is that you're a craft beer lover. Tell us about this love of craft beer.
Oh my goodness. There's nothing like discovering a great local brewer. I mean, I travel a lot as a writer and someone who works in the industry. So I would often try to find like the local beer. And just in the last 10 years, the scene has exploded. I've tried so far just in the last 4 or 5 years, and I started tracking more than 5,000 different beers, which I check in on Untappd. And ironically, it kind of leads to a pet project that my partner and I have been working on, because she loves craft beer just as much as I do and loves traveling and loves she's explored a lot of haunted places with me. We've actually had a couple weird experiences, paranormal experiences when traveling, but we're working on Spirits Untappd, haunted bars and breweries.
Oh, very cool.
Then if I can combine our love of craft beer and haunted places, I mean, we've been researching this book for years, and it's going to take a while to write because it's a really good tax write-off. It's a good excuse to get into some great bars and breweries, and the people have been amazing when I go to a place that's haunted. And I tell them, oh, I'm Mark Leslie. I'm the author of, you know, Haunted Hospitals and Tomes of Terror and all these other haunted locations, and ask about the ghosts. When I get the right person, they'll say, oh, do you want to come into the basement and see where the ghost has been seen? Do you want to go up and see the attic that no one ever gets to go see? And it's amazing how accommodating and wonderful people are when you're working on a book like that.
I kind of did the same thing, combined my love for being a broadcaster with a program that I do on weekends called Booze, Brews, and Bros. And we talk about a whole bunch of things like this, but in a more casual way. And we have a few beers while we're doing it. And
that sounds ideal. I don't know why I'm not a number one fan of that yet.
and it, you know, makes it loosens the tongue a little bit. The stories flow. It's a lot of fun. You just have to be careful if you're writing a book like you are about this. You got to be careful because some of those craft beers are much stronger than the beer you'll buy at a grocery store or such.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. That is true. I mean, some of them, like 14%
stouts
and things like that. But it's ironic. The very first book, Haunted Hamilton, I was writing about a haunted pub called The Winking Judge in Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, I didn't make it. I didn't actually get into that pub until after the book was published. I was doing the research based on articles I've read that were in the newspaper and paranormal research groups that had done stories. So it wasn't until the book came out I went, I handed a copy to the manager, said, hey, this is a book about the pub. I since became a regular at the pub, and you can say I ended up haunting it for years. And it's still one of my favorite haunts when I'm back in Hamilton to hang out at the Judge. I haven't seen anything strange, you know, up on the second floor, like the judge that allegedly from the men's room on the second floor, you see him floating outside the window looking in at you. I avoid looking out the window when I'm up there for that reason. I just want to enjoy the craft beer.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting, as we're going to be talking about haunted hospitals in a moment here, and hospitals seem to have a higher than normal level of activity as a group than maybe other types of buildings. But pubs also rank right up there. What is it about spirits and spirits?
Spirits and spirits. You know what? I think hospitals and pubs share one thing in common, is that they're places of highs and lows. And when you think about whether you think a ghost is a residual spirit as opposed to an intelligent haunting, and you think at a pub, people are celebratory, they're partying, they're you know, people fall in love, people fall out of love, horrible things happen, people are depressed. In hospitals, great things happen, horrible things happen, the highs and lows of emotions. So when you think about residual hauntings, what places would have the most residual effect than, you know, bars, pubs, or hospitals, if that's one of the things that you believe that a ghost could be? So those are two places that are rife for experience. Now, of course, the other thing I think about pubs is we close our minds. When we're children, there's a lot of things. We actually have better taste buds when we're kids. And then the reason we like more food when we get older is because our taste buds die off the older we get. And so let's imagine that when you're kids, you know, the reason I was scared of the monster under my bed when I was a kid, and I still am, is because I could tell that there was one there. And as you grow up, you lose your ability to sense that. And some people call that growing up. I'd say that's, you know, growing blind to the monsters that are really there. And so I wonder if when you're at a pub, if the alcohol loosens a little bit of those inhibitions that have been forced on you, and maybe you're actually open to seeing things. Some people might say maybe you're seeing things because of the alcohol. Someone else might say maybe you've just loosened up a little bit.
That's a great observation. And I also like the observation that you made regarding hospitals and pubs, and these are locations that have a lot of emotion. And I'll add to that list battlefields. I mean, we all know that Gettysburg is one of the most active paranormal places. I mean, I cannot tell you the number of people in this industry that start their professional story with saying, well, I was in Gettysburg and I had this experience. Because there's a lot of emotion there. So, I mean, based on just that anecdote, we could probably say with a lot of confidence that emotional energy has something to do with what we're talking about here.
Oh, yeah, most likely. Yeah, most likely, for sure. And I mean, in hospitals, on top of the emotion, think about a place where people come and go in and out of this world, right? You're born, lots of people die.
Yeah.
Battlefields as well. Less people die in pubs than in battlefields. But when you think about that, any places where people come into the world or leave the world, I think of it like a channel or a stream. Imagine like a small stream with a little bit of water trickling, and the more water that flows through there, it just erodes the sides and it becomes a thicker stream. So imagine places like battlefields or hospitals where there is that activity between our world and the other world, that it's wider and therefore more things can pass through. So that's another theory that kind of fits in with those locales as well.
Your earlier books seem to focus on a city at a time, kind of. Haunted hospitals is a little bit different. It's a type of facility as opposed to a single geographic location. What drew your attention to the hospital phenomenon?
It was kind of funny. So I'd had a few books out already on specific cities, and they were usually cities I lived in, and realized, hey, there's never been a book of ghost stories about the city. I should write one so people who love the city can learn more about it in a fun way. And I was at a conference in Calgary, Alberta, a writer's conference. And at the end of the one day, you know, the sessions are over and the writers are sitting around drinking. I was probably having a craft beer. Rhonda Parrish was sitting with me and a whole bunch of other writers. And that particular time, she leaned over and whispered, "I live near a haunted hospital." And so, of course, I leaned in and said, tell me more. And we just kind of went off into our own little world. We spent the next hour sharing stories. She was talking about this hospital in the neighborhood in Edmonton, Alberta, where she lived. And I shared some stories that I had picked up but had never used in any of my books because I didn't have enough to make a full chapter. And then by the next day, we realized we've got to write this book. I'll pitch it to my publisher. They wanted it. And this was neat because it was like 30% of the stories are Canadian, 30% are U.S., and then 30% are kind of rest of the world. We wanted to focus on North America, but that was I love when a collaboration just happens out of a casual conversation. Yeah. That's so much fun.
I don't know. I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but my very faulty memory seems to be saying something to me right now that there's a film. It's actually one of my favorite more recent films called Grave Encounters. And this is a film about TV ghost hunters, basically, that have an episode that goes terribly wrong and they disappear and the people find the footage of the episode and they watch it. And it seems to me it was filmed in a Canadian, I think it was an abandoned hospital.
I bet you it was in British Columbia. I bet you it was... what's the name of the hospital now? I'm drawing a blank. Hang on. It was the Riverview Hospital, probably, in British Columbia, because that's been in countless movies. I know they filmed multiple episodes of Supernatural there, The X-Files. I wonder if that's the location you're thinking.
I'm going to ask folks in my chat room to look it up for me. The film is called Grave Encounters, and not the second one, but the first one. And I'm curious as to what facility it was filmed at. So they'll let us know here in a few minutes. So as you started to explore this, where did you get the most of the stories from? Obviously, you had a few amongst friends, and you chatted about them. That kind of fueled the idea. But how did you start collecting the others?
So there's a few different things we did. So because it was co-authored, Rhonda and I had a shared Google Doc. And so she was going to write about the Charles Camsell Hospital in her neighborhood. I was going to write about a couple places near where I lived or I had already even written about in previous books, right? So the haunted hospital that was in Spooky Sudbury, I just came back, went back to my research and took the approach of the hospital as opposed to the city. So we did that. We also we went and did some searches. We did we watched a lot of shows. We follow paranormal investigators to see what they're doing and places they've gone to. Television shows that if they're no longer on the air, we get the DVDs. Get a lot of books, and then I even will put out I even have a call for a couple new books I'm working on right now. But there's a form on my website because a lot of times people will want to share their own paranormal experience. And so to make it easier, I have an online form that basically says, is this about a place? Did it happen to you? Did you hear from, check boxes? Tell me a little bit about it. Can I use your name? Can I call you? Can I email you for more details? Because a lot of times people don't give me enough. I need to get back to them and ask a few more questions. Should I use a pseudonym for you? Or can I share your name, right, to protect your innocence, and then ask for their permission to use the story. And then in some cases, there's a story I have for a forthcoming book where a woman was bitten by a demon, and she believes it was a demon that bit her, and she's got pictures of the bite marks that had happened. So, sometimes they'll submit a photo or even a photo of the locale where they were. It's a combination of research. Now, the other thing I will do, I love going on ghost walks. So whenever I get an opportunity. So for example, for Creepy Capital, when I was writing the Ottawa book, I lived in Ottawa for 10 years, but Liz and I went on multiple ghost walks that they ran in the area. And often when you talk to the owners at these places, they're willing to sit down, at a pub with you or over a coffee and share those stories. Oftentimes when I'm doing book signings at libraries or bookstores, almost every single time I've done an in-person event and people find out what I write, they usually kind of wait till no one else is around, and then they say, listen, I got to tell you a story.
Right.
And so oftentimes I pull out a pad of paper and say, do you mind if I write this down? Because I'm going to forget it. So I love being able to get multiple sources for a story so I can layer it with personal experiences, research from books and newspapers and magazines. I pay for subscriptions to archives of newspaper archive, and I'm constantly pouring through newspaper archive, which is how I discovered the penchant for columns of ghost stories, true ghost stories in newspapers that was so popular around the turn of the last century.
Just to update you, I asked Chad about what hospital it was that Grave Encounters was filmed at, and I got a couple responses. Riverview Hospital? Is that the
Riverview
one? In Coquitlam,
yeah.
British Columbia?
Coquitlam in British Columbia, yeah, that's right. The Riverview, yeah. That is, that's been the site of it's just this beautiful old building. And it was actually some of the stories that I remember collecting came from film crews that were in the building.
Oh,
you know, one of them being chased by these ghost dogs, and that never materialized, thank goodness.
Wow.
They leapt through the air and then just disappeared before they actually attacked.
Well, if you like ghost movies and you like scary movies and you like haunted hospitals and you haven't seen Grave Encounters, I'd highly recommend it. It's actually a good one.
You know what? I wrote it down. It's something I'm going to have to check out. Thank you. I appreciate that.
You said that you've had some personal experiences too. Can you tell us of any of them?
Yeah. So one of the times, so Liz and I were driving back from Orlando, Florida, back up to Ontario, Canada. And haunted hospitals had just come out. I think it had come out like 3 months earlier. And we were going to be coming through West Virginia on our way back. And it was the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum,
yep,
which Rhonda had written about. So when my co-author would write about it, I don't know the details as well. I don't know all the intimate details in the stories the way I would if I had written that chapter. So it was fascinating to me to know, oh, this is one of Rhonda's chapters, but I'm going to go there. I'm going to get some pictures. And we went on a 90-minute tour of the wing for the criminally insane, right? It was just a fascinating tour. So I got to see some firsthand things, took hundreds of pictures. And it was on the way there. So nothing creepy happened in that hospital, although it's allegedly one of the most haunted places around. But one of the things that happened was coming the night before, so we were driving from Orlando, we're on the highway for 14 hours, we wanted to get there, we wanted to check into a hotel, go on the tour first thing in the morning, and then get back in the car and probably another 6 or 7 hours to get home. And so that would be fine. We get in around 1 in the morning, we go to check into the first hotel. First hotel, in the middle of nowhere, West Virginia. And just in the hills, just prior to getting into the town, foggy mountains. And they're like, no, there's no beds. So they keep going down the highway. They'll be in a Econo Lodge. They'll probably have rooms. And so we get in the highway. Liz is driving. I run into the Econo Lodge, and they say, well, we have one room left. And this sounds like one of those creepy horror stories.
Yeah, it does.
There's one room left, and there's no queen or king-size bed. It's two double beds. And I was like, hey, it's 1 in the morning. We're going to bed. We'll take it. So we check in, we move into the room. Liz is really, really tired. She says, I'll take the bed beside the bathroom. You take the one closest to the door. And she's out like a light. Like, she can just sleep at the drop of a hat, and she's brave. She's not the chicken like me. It takes me forever to fall asleep. So she puts a hoodie on because it's kind of chilly. She rolls over, faces the wall. She's out. Takes me a while to go to sleep. I got to read a little bit. Got to read something calm and peaceful. And then I finally fall asleep, and I wake up, and I hear her get out of bed, and I look up, and I see her at the end of the bed, and I can hear her feet shuffling as she's moving towards the washroom. And I lay there, and I'm waiting for her to turn on the washroom light, and I'm laying, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting. I'm like, why is she not turning on the light? And then I can hear her breathing in the bed beside me, and I sat up and went, oh, my God, there's a woman in the room. And I freaked out because we had stayed in a way crappier hotel that was very similar to the layout on the way down. And I remember we were so scared that we actually, not of ghosts or anything, but we actually put furniture in front of the door just to, we were worried about someone breaking in. And so I sat up and went, oh my God, there's a woman in the room. And I looked around and I checked, and I was like, no, the latch is still on the door. Mark, calm down, relax, you're fine. I looked. My laptop bag was there. You know, our passports are sitting on the table at the end of my bed. Everything's fine. it's your imagination. You've, you know, been on the highway all day. You're going to a haunted place tomorrow. Go to sleep, you idiot. Do not wake her up. Because I'm the kind of guy, when we'd be camping, I'd be like, Liz, I think Bigfoot's outside. You know, I get scared of things. So I finally managed to calm myself down enough to go back to sleep. And then it must have been, I don't know. The other thing I told myself is I thought, I was laying there. I saw Liz get up. She moved into the bathroom. I fell asleep. And you know how you fall asleep and you've been asleep for 5 minutes, but it felt like 30 seconds passed?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I thought maybe I fell asleep. She went back to bed. I woke up and thought 30 seconds had passed, but it really been 5 minutes. So that's how I explained it to myself. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to go to sleep.
Right.
So then, I don't know, so I go back to sleep, and I hear this clunking noise as if something had dropped, like a phone or something had dropped onto the table at the end of my bed where my laptop bag and everything was. And I sat up again, and I said, there's someone in a room. I can hear them. I can feel them. And I checked the door again. The door is fine. And I look at to see if there's an adjoining door to another room. There is not one. And I'm thinking, okay, you're crazy. You go back to bed. So I ended up going back to bed. Nothing else happened. I woke up in the morning and I thought I would share with her. I said, hey, a funny thing happened. Did you get up and go to the bathroom in the middle of the night? And she goes, oh no, I didn't get up at all. I was out. You know, I rolled over, didn't even, you know, move the whole night. And then I told her what I thought I saw and heard. And she said, well, I wasn't going to say anything, but in the middle of the night, I was laying there facing the wall, and I felt someone standing over me. She said, at first I thought it was you, but then I felt a hand on my shoulder, and that wasn't your hand. I know your touch. It was not your touch. And I realized it wasn't you. It was a woman that was touching my shoulder. And she thought, oh my God, someone's broken into the room. Now, she's very feisty and brave. So she steals herself up and is ready to roll over and just nail them. And there's nothing there. There's nobody there. And she went back to sleep thinking that she had just, you know, been dreaming. And it wasn't until I said I thought I saw a woman at the end of her bed shuffling around the end of the bed and that I heard something in the room that she said, well, I felt something. And she felt definitely that there was a woman there. So that was kind of freaky. Now, of course, I rushed down to the hotel desk in the morning, and I didn't say what happened. I just asked, anyone ever reported any strange things? And I haven't been able to find any other stories from that locale. But if I do a haunted hotels book,
yeah,
that'll probably get in there.
Yeah, well, that's another category. I mean, I know as somebody who's done a lot of ghost hunting and worked with the TV show Ghost Hunters for a lot of years, we had a lot of success with hotels. In fact, the Stanley Hotel is one of our favorite places, the inspiration for Stephen King's Shining.
Oh, yeah, of course. And I think about hotels, right? Think about all the things that happen.
Yeah.
In hotel rooms, right. And the tragedies and the highs and the lows too, right?
That's exactly right. Let's talk about a few of the stories in haunted hospitals. What are some of the ones that particularly send shivers down your spine?
So one of them came when I was on a late night radio program, and it came from somebody who called in, and he was working at this Pinoca Institute in Alberta. And this just still makes my hair stand on end. So he was working there, and there was a woman who had been institutionalized her entire life. She'd lived there since she was a young teenager. And she would often have violent outbursts, and she had this supernatural strength that she could throw people off of her. They constantly had to sedate her. She would bite. She would fight with them. There was belief in some of the staff there that she must have been possessed in order for her to contain, because she was a relatively small woman, but she had such strength. And other things would happen in this hospital, where she would be in a room and the room would be ice cold, and she would complain about being freezing cold. And they would check, and there's nothing wrong with the thermostat or the heater. Everything was fine. They'd move her into another room. The room she had been in would go back to normal temperature, and then the one they moved her to would be freezing again, as if it was following her around. Well, one night he was working and had to do some rounds and go and check in on the patients to make sure everything was okay. And he gets to her room. He walks into the room, and he opens the room, and she's standing there in the dark, mm-hmm. in the middle of the night, which is kind of creepy on its own.
Yeah.
But she's not standing on the floor. She's standing horizontally with her feet on the wall. She's about 3 feet off the floor, standing out as if gravity is not affecting her at all, although it was affecting her hair, so her hair was hanging down.
So she was parallel to the floor.
Parallel to the floor.
Wow.
3 feet up with her feet on the wall, and she seemed to be sleeping because he could hear the breathing noises that she was sleeping. He closed the door, went back to the TV room, and just sat there and stared at the TV, had no idea what was on, didn't say anything to any of the other workers, didn't know what to say. He had relayed that story on this radio program, and it was another listener to the radio program who recognized his voice, because he used a fake name, and recognized the institution and had worked with him, contacted him the next week, went out for coffee and said, listen, you shared that story. I never told you something that happened to me. He had been working around the same time, had gone into the hospital one night into one in her room, and he saw the same sort of thing, except what he saw is she was standing about 3 feet off the floor straight up with her feet, like, so she was vertical. And again, she was sleeping. She was completely out of it. She had no idea what was going on, but her body was just levitating in space there. And again, he didn't say anything until he heard his friend reveal that. And the two of them kind of felt a little bit better because they realized that they weren't alone, that they weren't the only ones who did it.
I guess there's some comfort there, but still, wow.
Yeah, and I just remember I was in my apartment. It was probably 2 a.m. when I was on this program, and I was just, you know, there's just the one spot of light above me, and I'm just thinking, oh, the shadows are creeping in now, and I'm imagining walking into my bedroom and seeing this woman standing on the side of the wall, and I was just like, oh, God. So that one stuck with me, and I was fortunate enough to be able to reach out to the producer of the radio program, get in contact with this gentleman who did end up sharing more details that I could add to the book. But yeah, that stuck with me.
After you found out about this story and you wrote about it, did you get any indication as to whether or not there was any clergy ever involved or any follow-up to that whereby, a possession was investigated? Did you get hear anything about that?
Well, no. I remember him explaining that the staff would often have meetings about her, about how to deal with her, because they didn't know how to deal with her. They didn't know, you know, the only way they could deal with her half the time was to tranquilize her because of the outburst. But I don't recall them talking about bringing in an exorcist or something like that.
Wow. I mean, it wouldn't take too many instances of me walking into a room and seeing a girl standing on the wall perpendicular or parallel to the floor before I'd look for some professional help. Wow, that's a great story though. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was a freaky one.
When you do interviews like this or others, I know you've done many, and you start telling some of these stories, do you get people that reach out to you and say, hey, I've got one for you?
Yeah, actually, which is why I have the form on my website. I actually had somebody reach out to me on Twitter just a couple of days ago to start to share some stories. And I was like, you know, 140 characters is difficult. Let's just do a video chat. Hey, can we chat about it. And if you're willing, I'm record it. Or that's why I have the form on the website, because there's so many people who've had experiences and they feel like they're alone. But then they realize, oh my God, I've had something that was weird. I can't explain it, and so that happens all the time, which is why I end up creating those forms. And the forms are also just so people can understand. I think if I can give you an example of one of the ones that came in on a form.
Yeah, sure, love to hear it.
Is it more of a UFO story? But the gentleman had filled out my form, and he had basically said, "Oh, we were hunting in the middle of the woods in northern Ontario, and we woke up in the middle of the night, and there's this weird bright light, and it lit up the entire sky like it was the middle of the afternoon, and then it disappeared, and then it was quiet for a good minute or two, and then the crickets and all the night creatures and critters that you would normally hear came back on." And I thought, well, that was fascinating, but that would have been like a paragraph. I needed longer.
Right.
So I went back to him, asked more questions, found out, oh, no, he was 17. Oh, and it was the first time he had ever gone hunting. Oh, and here are some other things. And so more details came out as I asked more questions. And then I wrote the story, and I sent it to him because for authenticity, I ended up, as a storyteller, I elaborate and I fill in details that make sense to me, that dialogue and things that were probably said, and I usually show it to the person who shared the story to say, is this something that, does this sound true? Where am I wrong? Where am I right? Help me fix this. And he came back to me. So I told the story, and he was nervous. It was his first time. He was 17. He was with older boys. They were ribbing him. They were teasing him. They were mocking him. They were playing cards around the fire. There were fart jokes and all kinds of stuff. And I had different pieces of dialogue. And then in the middle of the night when they woke up, there was the dialogue of them talking to each other about, what is that? Do you hear that? And they rush out and stumble out of the trailer and look up into the sky, and it's the reaction they all have seeing each other. And I did elaborate quite a bit, and I sent it to him, and he wrote back, and he goes, oh, my God, it's like you were there. And I realized I was just filling in the details with what made sense to me,
right,
based on, you know, rite of passage for men in hunting communities and stuff like that. And so I find I can often get the real story or the depth of the story by having that back and forth, just asking more questions or sometimes filling in the detail with something that feels like it makes sense. And then they can tell me if I'm wrong and I cut it or I elaborate more.
Okay. Mark, I've got to ask you, who the heck is Barnaby Bones?
Barnaby Bones is my skeletal companion. So, I realized because of the kinds of books I write, often you walk in a mall and you see some lonely author sitting at a table with a bunch of books,
right,
and nobody wants to make eye contact with them, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what I realized, and it started off with a skull called Yorick that it used to put on the table with me. And then I got a full-size 6-foot skeleton, Barnaby Bones, and I'd sit him beside the table with me because it tells you one of two things. If you're into the paranormal or macabre or the unknown, unexpected, you're probably going to be attracted and come over to see what I'm up to. Or you're going to turn the other way and never want to talk to me because you know to avoid me because that's not your cup of tea. Okay. So Barnaby's also an icebreaker. So a lot of people will come up and make a joke about my buddy looks like he's been sitting there a long time or he needs to eat, which is a perfect joke to say, well, if only somebody would buy a book, then maybe I could feed him. But the icebreaker is great because it gives people an excuse to come talk to you. And so Barnaby, I actually have four of them now because the Barnaby hanging behind me on the wall in the office here, if this were a video chat, you'd see him over my shoulder looking down on me. His legs broke off because the spine's break because I travel with him a lot of places. I actually have two other ones in my car right now. One of them is a full skeleton that I would take and bring into events. The other one, again, is the upper half of the torso because right now there's kids walking by in the neighborhood and they love seeing them dressed up in different costumes. But he's just been a companion. I also put a T-shirt on with my book cover, sit him in the mall. People want to take pictures with him. Wow. It's just a really fun branding exercise as an author, and it's just been something that's been part of my brand. Now, when people see skeletons or skull stuff, they'll just share it to my Facebook page. Hey, I saw this really cool skeleton thing, this decor, and of course, our entire house is there's probably like 12 or 15 skulls in the in my home office here, and a skull cup near the front door where we just put our keys in. It's one of those fountains,
mm-hmm,
those big standing fountains,
right,
just like a bunch of skulls piled up on top. Most people buy them for Halloween. We just keep them out all year round.
Oh, that's awesome. I have to tell you, I helped a friend clean out a garage once of somebody who had passed away, and we're going through a bunch of just stuff. And there was this garbage bag and we pulled out the garbage bag, opened it up. And inside this garbage bag was a full human skeleton, which really freaked us out. Now it turns out
human skeleton.
Yeah, it was real. And it turned the home belonged to a physician and this skeleton had been in their office, but even so we had to call the police and the police had to come and determine, the origin and all this stuff. I mean, it was a real, real ordeal, when you find a human skeleton.
Wow.
Yeah, it was wild. So I'm assuming Barnaby isn't actually real human bones.
No, Barnaby is plastic. Okay. Barnaby is plastic. So Barnaby the Fourth, I guess, is the one that I'm currently on.
We're almost out of time here. I know you're working on other things. I want you to take a second and go back to something you mentioned early in our conversation about these tales that your publisher said were too dark to be included. I think you said it was in Macabre Montreal. I think that was the book.
Yeah.
And these are going to be published separately?
Yeah, so Too Macabre for Montreal is going to be coming out in the fall of 2020. And so that'll be available in print and in ebook format. And it's short enough, I can probably narrate the audiobook because it's going to be less than 20,000 words. So it'll be available in all formats. Should be available through libraries, bookstores, whatever. So easily consumable in different formats.
And is Haunted Hospitals available now?
Oh, Haunted Hospitals is available in ebook and print. It's available everywhere online that you can find books, like Amazon, etc. You can order it through a local bookstore. Ask for it at your local library, too.
And I know you have a form on your website that people can fill out if they want to share a story. Is that the best way for them to do that?
Yeah. So I'm currently working on another book, Demonic Dolls, Screaming Skulls, and Other Haunted Objects.
Oh, wow.
So Haunted Objects is one I'm working on. Weird Waterloo. A lot of your listening audience probably don't live in Waterloo, Ontario, but that's where I live. Because, again, I want to write a ghost story about the city I live in now.
Sure.
There's a lot. And, of course, haunted bars and breweries, Spirits Untapped. So constantly looking for fresh new stories.
A lot of great stuff coming up from you, Mark, and I hope you'll agree to come back. This has been a great time tonight, a great conversation. I've had a lot of fun.
Oh, I have too. It was awesome chatting with you, JB.
Thanks so much. And again, the website is marklesley.ca, as in Canada.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by J.V. Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Joha Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.